Good morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, at some time in the lives of most Catholic young men, and even older men, the thought of becoming a priest takes form. A lot of guys entertain it for a little while and go on to pursue something else, but for some others, it's an idea that keeps coming back. For those men, our first guest today is the man to see. I'm very happy this morning to welcome an old pal of mine to the studio, Father John Moneypenny. Father John is the Director of Vocations for the Diocese of Orange, and he is the go-to guy when you're a man who's beginning to give serious thought to the idea of a career as a priest. Father John and I have both seen this process from the inside during our time as students together at St. John's Seminary in Camarillo. Father John, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, let's demystify a couple things right from the get-go. If a man comes to you and wants to talk about the priesthood, you are not going to throw a net over him and haul him off to the seminary and handcuff him to a desk. Now, how does this idea of a priesthood typically occur, and what's typical of the initial process of discernment, which is an important word to know?
Well, great, Pat. That's a great question. Usually it begins at the home. It begins at the home or and at the parish where a young man is, you know, attending daily mass, maybe involved in different ministries at the parish. Maybe the parish priest or a nun or someone in the parish sees in him a quality that says, or maybe even ask him, hey, have you ever thought about being a priest? And it's usually from that invitation at a parish and by a priest or someone there and directing them to come and to see me or come to one of my discernment meetings that I have monthly and to have a dialogue and a conversation.
Well, tell us about kind of the next step in the process. They used to be called come and see weekends, where you would actually spend a weekend up at the seminary. Yeah. What are they called now?
Well, we call them priestly discernment retreat, or they call it by PDR. So if you're ever up at the seminary for a PDR weekend, you'll like, what is the heck is a PDR? Well, it's a priestly discernment retreat.
And tell us what happens on one
of those retreats is men are invited to come up, usually come up on a Friday and leave on a Sunday, and have the opportunity to pray and to reflect upon that idea of priesthood, to listen to talks, to have the different seminarians come and show them the campus, help them to reflect on that very question, is God calling me to be a priest, and how do I know that? How do I really get in touch with that thought of possibly serving God as a diocesan priest?
Well, you also get to know a little bit about the guys who are already up there who mm-hmm. can give you firsthand knowledge about that, and I can speak for myself here. The first retreat I went to at St. John's years ago, I was very impressed by the fact that the guys up there weren't a bunch of otherworldly holy
types.
You know, floating around on pink clouds.
And it really helps to demystify the idea of, well, I'm going away to the seminary and it's something way far away and way foreign to reality. Really, it's guys who go up for the weekends really see the guys are real. People who are thinking about being the priest are just like you and I, or just like anyone else, and but are desiring to serve God in a very unique and special way.
Well, it's no secret, of course, that the church needs more priests. It's a definite need, and it's an ongoing need. But nobody is going to rush or fast-track a guy who's in discernment through the discernment process. It's an intensely personal decision.
It is, and I, you know, from guys coming to the discernment monthly meetings that I have, you know, when they come, it's an open forum. It's just about conversation, about talk. There isn't any signing on any dotted line. No one's going to handcuff you to the desk, as you say, and ship you off to the seminary. No, it's that deep personal desire first to explore the possibility that God might be calling me to this, even before going to a seminary. And then once you're at the seminary, you're not ordained yet. Typically, it's about, the average guy, it's about 7 years.
Yeah.
About 7 years of a journey to continue to think about, is God really calling me to this? And is the church inviting me to this? Because it's both sides. And it really is that honest discernment. When someone decides to leave the seminary, people go, oh my gosh, he died. He's gone, and there's a mourning, and there's a sadness. But really, that's what discernment's about. It's about figuring figuring out if this is really what God wants me to do. And someone leaving the seminary is just that next phase of their life of saying, because they're going to go on and be a very active member of their parish and a good, faithful Catholic.
Yeah, and once they're in the seminary, this is something you just brought up, the idea that you have a long time in order to pray and think and ruminate. And most of the guys have never had an opportunity like that before, where they have all this latitude just to consider their future.
Yeah, what a great opportunity. I tell our seminarians that. Who else has the opportunity to step out from the busyness of life and merely to study and to pray and to figure out what God wants you to do with your life? What a great opportunity to do that when you're in discernment.
When you first get there, if you're used to a life of, say you're working at a job or you're living a life out in the community where you have lots of obligations, you have lots of appointments, things like that, it can take a little while to get used to that. But once you're used to it, you think of it as such a luxury.
That's a difference of today's seminarian versus 20 or 30 years ago, where guys would come directly out of high school, maybe go out into a college seminary program and then to theology.
Mm-hmm.
Now most guys are coming from a second career. Maybe they've been involved in business or something else in life and have come to the seminary and have to make a huge adjustment to living. Maybe they had to give up their home or had to give up their apartment or something and live in a dormitory.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And thank God St. John's now, they all have their own individual bathroom. So that's a good thing. That's a good plus.
Yes.
So there's been some modernization of the seminary since our time there.
Speaking as one whose work assignment was to clean those bathrooms, I'm very much in favor of that. I want to bring up a mutual friend of ours, Father Paul Spellman, whom we had on the show recently, as an example of one of the what used to be called late vocations.
Sure.
He began in the seminary at age 40 or 41, I believe, and his previous job, he was pulling down six figures as an accountant for Price Waterhouse, living in an apartment down in the South Bay. I mean, he had the Southern California bachelor existence really knocked, and he felt it was the thing that he wanted to do, to go to the seminary and take it to the next level,
right.
Which is what you're doing when you go to the seminary, right? And he is now a wonderful priest.
Yes, he is,
in
yeah.
Venice and very mm-hmm. happy at it.
Yeah, we really refer to them as later vocations anymore, because the average age of a seminary actually is about 30.
Wow.
About the average is about 30, and guys have come in from graduating with a bachelor's degree or something like that and then entering into study of theology then. So it's our oldest guy actually is in his 50s, who's in the seminary for the diocese.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Second career guy, really worked in banks and worked in all sorts of stuff. Maybe you should have him on the show someday.
I'd love to. I mean, and there have been histories of guys up there who have been married and who have had children and whose wives have passed away. And later in life, that old idea of being a priest came back to them, and they were ordained in their 60s, and their kids came to their ordination. You know,
we might have that for the first time in our diocese.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I remember a guy who was like that. He was for L.A. Name I don't recall, but yeah, he was there.
So we have guys as young as in college seminary and guys as oldest who have had their own companies and are now, you know, entering the seminary because they feel that call, that discernment is really strong in their life, and they want to respond to what God is calling them to do.
Well, in the next couple of minutes, I want to examine a couple of things that sometimes loom large in the minds of guys who are giving serious thought to the priesthood, one of which is, what are my family and my friends going to say? What experience have you had with that?
Well, you know, it's varied. Majority of guys coming into it have the support of their families, and it could be a shock to friends at first of saying, are you seriously thinking about becoming a priest? Are you seriously thinking about going to the seminary?
Mm-hmm.
And at first, it could be a shock if it's someone who isn't very much a churchgoer.
Mm-hmm.
But usually guys who are thinking about being the priest are somehow connected to their parish, and usually it's a real positive experience for guys. On occasion, you get guys who don't have the support of their family, or they're really stepping out of something that, you know, is very challenging and difficult. But that's I highly respect them too, of doing something that they know is what they're called to do, but it's struggling to let go of what they had.
Well, let's talk about the C word here for a minute, the requirement of celibacy. Now, this is a big deal to most of the guys, and there's really no getting around it. And at the seminary, guys even make light of it. They talk about some days having a bad celibacy day. You know, we all know what, you know, we're talking about there. But we still turn out priests who are happy and fulfilled in their work. Now, how does this play out in reality?
You know, I think we are all called to live a chaste life. We're all called to live in the way of God. And I think, as I like to call it, you know, we're calling guys to be happy, to be healthy, and to be holy. And if you have a balance of those three things in your life, you know you're where God is calling you to be. And happiness, not as the world deems happiness, but what happiness that comes from God. For healthy, that you're living, you're respecting your body, you're exercising, you're doing all the things in order to make this a temple of the Holy Spirit, you know, and also of holy, that you're a person of prayer. And if you have those three things in your life, then a guy who's a celibate can live a very happy life and be able to share his life and be in communion and dialogue with others.
Okay, we've gotten you through the discernment process. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk with Father John Moneypenny about what life is like as a seminary student and what it's like to be a freshly minted priest. Stay with us.
In tribute to the life of Dr. Robert Schuller, founder of the Crystal Cathedral, a concert featuring Verdi's Requiem will be presented at 8 p.m. on Friday, May 8th at the Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. Hear Verdi's Requiem with a 60-piece orchestra, 200-voice choir, and premier soloists from around the world. Tickets are available online at cathedralrequiem.eventbrite.com or by calling 714-883-7987.
We're back with Father John Moneypenny, the Director of Vocations for the Diocese of Orange, and we're talking about the road to the priesthood and what it's like to go through the various steps. Well, okay, we're pretty sure that we want to take things to the next level and actually apply to enter the seminary. Yeah. What happens now? What's the application process and the interview process like?
Well, the interview and application process starts with getting to know a guy. You know, really to say, you know, if a guy comes to me in, one day and he says, well, I want to be a priest, give me an application. Well, it's not that easy.
Right,
it doesn't
start
that way. So it really starts with a kind of a dialogue and a communication for, it could be a couple of months, it could be a year. Some guys, it's longer than that. And I call that informal kind of discernment.
Mm-hmm.
And when it becomes formal discernment is when you actually enter into a formational program that's at the seminary.
Right.
And so it requires going through an application process, as you said. Which is a whole bunch of paperwork.
It really is.
It is. It's submitting of documents and your transcripts and your baptismal certificates and all those different kinds of things, and then going through a bunch of questionnaires and really to help a guy determine if I truly reflected that this is what God is calling me to do, and so helping a guy answer those questions about discernment, about am I really called to do this. And then there's also a psychological assessment, because it's very important today that a guy is balanced and a guy is going to be able to succeed well in formation.
Oh, sure.
So we really want to make sure that they have good sense of themselves. So we put a guy through, it's a pretty good, psychological assessment. Usually like a 3 or 4 hour interview, and plus with a whole bunch of, remember that thing called the MMPI?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Those are those things that we still require, because you really want to help really to get to know a guy on all aspects, spiritually, mentally, and all those different aspects, to make sure guys are truly a good candidate. And once that takes place, he submits all those final documents to me. I present it to the bishop and say, "Bishop, here's Pat, and Pat would like to enter the seminary, and here's his application. Do we take it to the next level and have him have an interview with the specific seminary, and then there's an interview process at the seminary, and then a determination is made there if acceptance happens or not."
So it's a fair amount of hoops the candidate has to jump through. By no means impossible, but the whole thing is set up to make sure you get guys who are suited.
Yeah, it's usually it takes about 3 to 6 months to really to vet a guy well, to really to make sure that this is truly an honest discernment. And it's also going up to the seminary for the PDR,
right?
Oh, well, yeah, for that priestly discernment retreat and have them get a sense of what the seminary is about. Mm-hmm. And if all those things all those ducks line up, then a guy really will then be accepted into formation and then begin that long journey of continued discernment. Because discernment doesn't end when you enter the seminary. It's really only beginning.
Well, that's why I wanted to make a point right at the top of the show that word discernment is something that's going to constantly come back, because you... just as you say, it doesn't stop when you enter the seminary. It doesn't even stop when you're almost ordained. You're still discerning, right up until maybe your last semester.
Yeah, a guy has the ability to put the brakes on everything, and so does the bishop.
Yes.
Put the brakes on everything right up to that moment in which the bishop lays his hands on a guy's head and ordains him a priest.
Tell us a little bit about what it's like in your first days in the seminary and after that, life day-to-day in the seminary. What sorts of classes a student will be taking in his first year, how he gets acclimated. I remember being very excited and very nervous at the same time.
Yeah.
I was happy to be there, but it was a combination of excitement and nervousness.
Yeah, it's really, usually it ended up being really a shock to someone's system when they've left everything behind and live at the seminary in a very small room, and with a schedule and all those things. So depending on a guy's life beforehand, it could be a really big adjustment. But the fraternity and the brothers that are there, who have been there a while, really kind of help a guy to really kind of acclimate.
I can speak, and of course you can too, to St. John's Seminary in Camarillo, and I imagine it is very much the same in the other seminaries that the guys who are discerning for the Diocese of Orange go to. But the atmosphere in the seminary is one of great tranquility, of great spirituality. It slows you right down.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
puts you in a contemplative frame of mind.
It does, and that really aids into studying what a priest needs to know, because they're really the study of philosophy, the study of theology, church history. There's learning how to preach. There's actually even learning Latin or learning Greek,
mm-hmm.
and also learning Spanish.
Yes.
Learning those different languages that are needed for the service within a diocese.
The second pastoral language.
Correct.
Depending on where you are.
So really a study of those things and of Scripture and of the sacraments. That's why it takes 7 years to get through the seminaries. There's so much information for a priest to know, in which he's only beginning to start, because a priest has to be a constant learner. You can't say one of them, the day I'm ordained, I know everything. Well, that's just when it's starting, actually.
Oh, yes.
And you must continue to educate and continue to inform yourself on how to better serve God's people.
What about the financial considerations? We were talking about that a little while ago, when some guys see it as a bit of a jolt when they have left their job, if they have been out in the world working. They've left their job, they've left their house or apartment, and now they find themselves in a dormitory room at the seminary, and they're thinking, "Oh my goodness, what just happened?"
Yeah, yeah.
What about that?
Yeah, that's a big shocker for a lot of guys. It depends on too, and when you enter the seminary, if you're coming down out of college, or if you've only worked very menial jobs and haven't had a career, and so depending on how that is for each individual person, when you get to the seminary, you don't work. There isn't a paycheck that's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't, and so our guys receive a little bit of a stipend to help them cover some of the basic essentials of life. You know, I got to go get a new toothbrush, or I got to get those different types of things for this normal existence in life. So the diocese helps to cover some of those things, and also helps to cover with the tuition and room and board as well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, how about some of the later years in the seminary? Now, the earlier years, you're studying a lot of foundational philosophy and foundational theology. As you go on, the classes tend to get more specific. They tend to get a little bit deeper, and you have a parish internship. What about that?
Sure. Yeah, the farther you get along, the more actual integration of topics comes up. You know, what is the pastoral application of Scripture? How do I administer the sacraments, and what does that mean to people, and how do you do it? And on the pastoral year that we do require for seminarians, it's a whole year living in a parish, living and working and living in a rectory and kind of just wearing it for a while, really.
Yeah, yeah.
To see, is this really the life that I could live, and is it the ministry in which I'm truly drawn to? And it's a very important year, it's a great year for a guy to truly deepen his discernment. There's that word again.
Yes.
Discernment. But it's constantly, figuring out if this is a good fit. Between, because God calls all the time, great, wonderful, but we also have to respond to that and fit into that as well. And so it's really the opportunity for a guy to discern, and also for the church to discern with him as well.
Absolutely. Well, okay, our man has finally made it through the seminary. He is newly ordained. What are those first few days and weeks as a priest like? Can you actually prepare for them, or are they just coming right at you?
It's a huge, burst of excitement and energy, and your first mass, your family, your friends around, and first blessings, and all of that great joy and grace that's just been put onto a guy. People love to go to someone's first mass, but I always think, my first mass wasn't my best mass. No, it's a grace-filled mass, but you're still figuring out what this book is about, this Roman Missal. Where do you put this? Where do you put that?
And you're trying not to trip over the furniture.
Trying not to trip over the furniture. But for some reason, I still remember my first Mass, and now all of that just kind of went away when it came to the moment of consecration. Mm-hmm. And almost it's like, is it really true that these hands consecrated by the bishop as a priest are making Jesus present here on this altar? And that's just the most awesome thing in the world. And you live that so, you're much on a high that whole first year of priesthood and celebrating those great gifts. And, you're kind of the rookie. You're the rookie, the new kid on the block.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a great joy to do those things for the very first time.
Well, before we say goodbye this morning, tell us a little bit about why you think the priesthood was the right decision for you. Get personal a bit here.
Oh, yeah. From very young age, I saw the priest on the altar as a kid and said, I would like, maybe God is calling me to do that someday. And really just felt that call from God early on. I'm one of those old guys. I'm not that old, but what the term that they call lifer.
Yeah.
There isn't a high school seminary anymore. There isn't. We don't have a college seminary at St. John's anymore. But when those were, if you attended all three of those, then you were given that term lifer.
Right.
And so some from a very early age feel that calling from God to serve. And I think really my vocation really stemmed from my mom. Her being a nurse, and that's call of service. So I think I got the call of service from her and the calling from God to serve him in the church, and feel really blessed to be able to do that each day.
Well, let's give our interested guys out there a little bit of contact information. If they are listening out there and they think this sounds like a great idea and they want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
Easiest way is to go to our website, ocvocations.org. And there's instructional videos, there's contact form, all our information is right there. So ocvocations.org.
ocvocations.org. Father John Moneypenny, thanks very much for stopping by today to give our listeners such a complete and inside look at discernment, seminary life, and priesthood. With a little luck, some of the listeners out there will be in touch with you soon.
Give me a call.
We'll be back in just a minute to learn about how you can get your bicycle blessed this weekend and how you can put it to work for a healthier body, a cleaner environment, and a better Orange County. Don't go away.
Thank you.
We're back, and May is National Bike Month, and here with us in the studio to talk about the many activities in Orange County that are associated with that is Corey Wilkerson. Corey is the Active Transportation Coordinator for the Orange County Transit Association. Now, you may think of OCTA as being buses, and it is, but that's not all. Corey, first of all, I'm curious what an Active Transportation Coordinator does. You're OCTA's bicycling promoter, in part?
Well, actually, just to clarify, I actually work for the city of Santa Ana.
Oh, all right.
OCTA does have an active transportation coordinator there. His name is Paul Martin. I work for the city of Santa Ana, and my role primarily is to kind of coordinate. The city has a lot of projects going on mm-hmm. at all times, and my primary task is just to make sure that all of the projects are considering bicyclists and pedestrians in the design, all of the programs and planning that we do to make sure that those particular users are considered. And that means doing a lot of things on a day-to-day basis that kind of changes from day to day.
Well, great. And I imagine it's going to be getting more and more active as time goes on, because Orange County, more and more, is it not, is turning into a really bicycle-friendly place.
I think that's the goal. I think that for a long time, Orange County has been, and the residents in Orange County have been so focused on moving cars and not really moving people. So this changing of the tides that's happening is, you know, you can only widen roads so far, you can only do so much to improve traffic flow, that at some point you need to take a step back and say, okay, we need to relook at how we allocate our space in our roadways.
Well, we're just a tiny bit late for this event, but this is something you can do every day. Today, May 7th, is Bike to Work Day. Are more and more people taking their bicycles and riding them to work all over the county?
Sure. I think that there's always been a core of cyclists that are interested in riding their bikes, but I think more and more you're seeing people make the choice to change their modes. The lower income communities here in Orange County that don't have access to a car, that don't have access to some other sort of transportation, their bike becomes their primary mode of transportation. And it's those users, I think, that we are really focusing on. Not as much as of the people that are choosing to use one mode or the other, but at this point, I think we're just trying to make sure that we're designing our streets to meet the existing needs of the bicycling population that's out there, that's often marginalized and is not always as visible.
Well, now, we're not talking about the guys out there in the spandex shorts and the $6,000 bicycles who are riding what they call centuries, 100-mile bike rides every weekend. We're talking about the people who use that bike to get from point A to point B, whatever point A and point B happen to be.
Correct. And we're not going to exclude the guys in the spandex. I mean, you know, they're just as much roadway users as anybody else.
Sure.
But they tend to ride primarily on the weekends. They're riding in the evenings. We want the roadways to be safe for them as well. But I think really it's that user that's dependent on the bicycle for their transportation that we really need to address, particularly the safety aspects of it.
Yes. And there's the 3-foot rule now that's getting a lot more recognition out there. Explain that, if you would.
So what it is that it's a change to the California Vehicle Code that requires motor vehicles to, if they're going to be passing a cyclist, to pass at a safe distance,
mm-hmm.
Not to buzz right past the cyclist that could cause them to either get sucked up in a gust or shoved into a parked car. It requires them to give about 3 feet of space in order to make it so they can safely get around the cyclist without injuring anybody.
An excellent rule, because I think that is one of the reasons a lot of people are a little bit wary about riding on a heavily trafficked street, because they think they're gonna come a little bit too close to the fast-moving traffic.
Correct. It becomes a high stress factor for cyclists when they're riding on an arterial where there's faster-moving traffic. It's not very comfortable when you're riding at 12 to 18 miles per hour to be sharing a space with a car that's moving 45, 50 miles an hour.
Sure. Well, OCTA has a wonderful website with a huge amount of information about cycling in Orange County. It is www.octa.net. That's the main website. And when you get to the opening page, just click on Share the Ride /Bike at the top of the page. One of the features that I love is the downloadable bike trail map of Orange County, because it's amazing how many of these off-street trails there are around the county. They're just everywhere.
Correct. And that's, the county has kind of embraced the recreational cycling and embraced the opportunities where they can put in bike facilities along corridors that would not be otherwise used for transportation along the rivers, along the Edison power lines, along, you know, available right away that isn't currently being used for transportation uses, and they've taken advantage of that, and so that kind of creates a freeway network, as it were, throughout the county. And they're still continuing to try and grow that. Our the city's Parks and Rec Department has been the kind of the lead agency in developing the Class 1 separated bike paths throughout the city, and then it's a matter of then using the local streets to connect to those trails to make for regional connectivity a little stronger.
Now, a Class 1 separated bike path is the kind of thing you're going to see in a lot of cities around the county, where you have a solid white stripe near the curb and you have a stencil of a bike on the inside of that lane. Is that what we're talking about?
No, that's actually it's considered a bike lane. It's or Class 2.
Okay.
That's along an existing arterial. You see a lot of those on, the city of Irvine has a massive network of bike lanes.
Uh-huh.
Class 1 bike paths are separated from the roadway in that they're running along, like, the Santa Ana River, for instance.
Oh, sure. Okay.
And so they run parallel with these other uses, but that are not necessarily transportation uses. So they're usually segregated from traffic. It's a much more comfortable place to ride a bike. Sometimes they weave themselves through residential neighborhoods. Sometimes they're, like I said, along the river trails. You can connect all the way up into the foothills and wherever.
Well, that brings me to this question. There is one thing that I just I loved as soon as I discovered it, the OC Loop, for people, I guess, who are out there and really enjoy a long ride. Tell us about the OC Loop.
The OC Loop is something that OCTA has been kind of promoting for a long time. And again, that's not my agency, but what they're working on is essentially a single loop that surrounds the county, allows you to access most of the county, at least the central county, and it's entirely off street. So again, it's a more low stress place to ride. It's a lot more comfortable place to ride. The Santa Ana River Trail is a part of that loop, and that runs through the city of Santa Ana. So that's kind of been our segment in the OC Loop. So the OCTA and the county as a whole has been kind of promoting this idea of the single network and this single loop that allows for people to be able to access. And so it's great for people that you, like you said, they want to get out and they want to ride a long distance. They don't want to have to deal with car traffic. They just want to get out and let off some steam or whatever and just ride.
And it includes such a wide variety of areas, all the way from Seal Beach to Huntington Beach and all the way up to the Yorba Linda area. And you mentioned the Santa Ana River Trail. That alone goes through, I think, four or five different cities over the course of 25 miles. It's a wonderful trip.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, a lot of our listeners are probably wondering, okay, what does all this have to do about Catholicism? Well, we come to this one event that's coming up this weekend, the Blessing of the Bikes. Tell us about that.
So the Blessing of the Bikes is becoming a tradition for Bike Month events. LA County partnered with Good Samaritan in LA County to do. I think they kind of started the idea of the Blessing of the Bikes, where it's essentially a blessing for all the riders that are going to be participating in the events, and it's just a nice way to kind of kick off the event. So the City of Santa Ana has been partnering with OCTA, with the Orange County Public Health or Healthcare Agency, to coordinate a bunch of events throughout the county, a lot of them being in Santa Ana, as with Santa Ana being the county seat and where all the Civic Center offices are. We've been partnering with all these different organizations. Santa Ana Active Streets has played a big role in helping to organize and bring people together. And so the kickoff that we're having is on Monday, May 11th,
right,
at 7 a.m. at the Santa Ana Regional Transportation Center, the Metrolink station in Santa Ana.
Right.
We're going to be in the courtyard. One of the friars is going to come out and give a blessing and, well-wishing for everyone, to safe travels for the events that'll be coming up for the week. And then from there, we'll be riding to City Hall and have a few more activities going on throughout the rest of the week.
Great. I happen to know that the priest that's going to be doing the blessing is Father Efrain Flores. He is the administrator at St. Joseph Church in Santa Ana, which is only a short walk from the Metrolink station. And I talked to him the other day. He's very excited about it. He's going to have a lot of fun there, and I'm sure everybody else will as well. Down to a real bedrock question here, and we touched on this a minute ago, but why don't more people think that bike riding is for them? Is there just something that they need to get over, a little mental block, a physical block? They think, oh, it's too strenuous, or I haven't ridden a bike since I was a kid, or what?
Sometimes it could be something just as simple as my bike has a flat tire, and all it needs is a pump to overcome that first barrier. But really what it is what you're talking about is barriers that prevent people from using a bicycle as transportation. And probably the best thing that the city and the county can do to address that is to address the issue of safety. If people don't feel safe to ride a bike, they're not going to ride a bike. So it's on jurisdictions like mine that to design streets that are safe and that are low stress and that people feel comfortable riding their bikes on. And then from there, it's just on them.
Well, Corey Wilkerson, many thanks for being with us today here in our studio, and thanks for all the excellent information about National Bike Month and all the activities associated with that in Orange County.
Thank you very much.
Once again, for more information about cycling in OC, go to www.octa.net and click on the Share the Ride /bike icon. Don't go away, because when we come back, we're going to be visiting with three brainy kids from St. Edward the Confessor School in Dana Point and their academic decathlon coach. This is Orange County Catholic Radio, AM 1000.
May 18th through May 23rd is Wills and Trusts Week in the Diocese of Orange and is proudly sponsored by the Orange Catholic Foundation and the Catholic Cemeteries. Take advantage of one of the free sessions and learn how to protect those you love with a new or updated estate plan. Through proper planning, the legacy of love and care you leave for your family and friends can be encouraging and inspiring. If you have questions on how to begin or update your estate plan, please join us at one of the many sessions planned at convenient parish locations throughout our diocese during the week of May 18th. For a complete list of locations and schedule, visit our website, orangecatholicfoundation.org. That's orangecatholicfoundation.org. Or call 714-282-3021. That's 714-282-3021. Admission is free and reservations are not necessary, but welcome. Details are available at orangecatholicfoundation.org. We look forward to seeing you soon.
In tribute to the life of Dr. Robert Schuller, founder of the Crystal Cathedral, a concert featuring Verdi's Requiem will be presented at 8 p.m. on Friday, May 8th at the Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. Hear Verdi's Requiem with a 60-piece orchestra, 200-voice choir, and premier soloists from around the world. Tickets are available online at cathedralrequiem.eventbrite.com or by calling 714-883-7987.
On the phone with us from Dana Point today are three students from St. Edward the Confessor School who recently represented the school in winning fashion at the State Academic Decathlon Championships in Sacramento, where the team took first place overall. They are the best academic decathlon team at their grade level in the entire state. First of all, big congratulations to all the kids on the team and to their head coach, Jackie Brady. Jackie, tell us a bit about the event and how it's structured and how your kids came out.
Well, it's structured into three separate events. They have two events that are group events, and the kids work as a team. They have a logic test that's 20 questions, and that's worth 8,000 points. They have a super quiz section, which is a Jeopardy style. It's open to everyone, can cheer their team on. They ask 50 questions, 10 per subject, and you can see their scores. There's a lot of cheering. It's very exciting. And then 8 of the 10 children also do individual events, and combined those scores are worth 8,000 points. So overall, we were so proud of the kids. They really did well in all the events, and that's how they came out with an overall first place. They got second in logic, second in super quiz, and then we had three first place winners in individual subjects, and we had two others that also placed in the top three. And all the kids in the individuals placed in the top half. So it was just a solid effort by the kids. We're very proud of them.
Now, these are kids in Sacramento who are from Catholic schools all over the state, right?
That's correct. Most of the dioceses in California are represented. The kids who are there are the winners of their respective dioceses. And then we also have the Archdiocese of Denver is also at the state competition. So there was a teacher, I guess, from Orange County who went out there years ago and started the event out in Colorado. So they've been coming a few times. And, in fact, their school won the logic portion. It was St. Thomas More. But, yes, all the schools were in Sacramento were the winners of their diocese.
Well, Claire Crafts is one of the kids who's on the phone with us right now. She came in first place in her individual category, which was religion. Claire, how do you prepare for a quiz like that?
It's a really long weeks of studying, putting in like at least 5 hours of studying a week. I tried to do a lot of repetitive quizzing myself. It was a little bit nerve-wracking at first thinking of it, but
I can imagine.
It felt really good to be up on that podium, though, after all those weeks of studying.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You've got to deal with a little bit of nerves, especially you're at the state level here. Is it difficult to stay focused, or once you're up there, do the butterflies leave and away you go?
Once you're there, you kind of realize you've worked the hardest you can. You've put in hours and hours and hours of studying, and it's just time to show what you know. So once you're there, all the butterflies went away, so...
Great. Well, can you give us an example of one of the types of questions you were asked? I've asked all three of the kids here today to come up with examples of questions to see if our listeners can get them. What's an example?
So we had to memorize, quotes from different saints and different Bible verses, and I have a quote here. Some saints describe themselves as terrible criminals because they saw God, they saw themselves, and they saw the difference. And so... it's the multiple choice possible answers were Pope John Paul II, St. Teresa of Calcutta, St. John Vianney, and St. Thomas Aquinas.
Ooh. I'm going to guess St. Thomas Aquinas.
Well, actually, it was St. Teresa of Calcutta.
Oh, no, no. Okay, that would have been my last guess. My goodness. Oh, okay. Well, I'm down one. Gavin Risling took a first place prize in the individual literature category. Do they ask you questions based on literature that you have read in class, or is it wider ranging than that? Does it go farther than that?
Well, there's a different book every year that we have to read. This year it was Heart of a Samurai.
Ah.
And that was about the first person from Japan to visit America. So they ask everything from the dates in the book to plot events to vocab.
My goodness. And how long does the test take?
About an hour. We have 50 minutes.
Really? And there are how many questions in the course of that time?
50 questions.
50 questions. Okay, so you're dealing with about a question a minute. You know, you've really got to keep pace.
Yeah.
Well, give us an example of one of the questions you were asked.
All right. The main character was on a whaling ship, so which of these was not the name of a type of sail? There's the topgallant, banker, galley, jib, or none of the above?
I'm going to say galley.
Yes, so it's the cook or the kitchen on the ship.
All right, okay. We're silently whooping it up here in the studio.
Very good.
Okay. Well, why do you think literature turned out to be one of your best subjects?
Well, I've always loved reading, and I thought being able to compete and show what I can do with it is a great experience. When you're studying something that you like, it's not really work.
Mm-hmm. And then this is something that just comes naturally to you, and the memory work is that much easier, huh?
Well, in a way, yeah. You still have to work for it, but it's a lot easier doing something you like to do.
Fantastic. Well, finally, Megan Rowlett, I got that right, did I not?
Yes.
Okay. You took a first place in the current events category, and you got a perfect score. Now, this has to be a real passion with you. Are you a news junkie who reads two papers and listens to all the news broadcasts?
Well, I wasn't at first, but after I finished doing current events, I just find myself picking up newspapers and reading them.
And do you find that now that you're kind of homing in on a current events category, that now you don't just read the papers and you don't just listen passively to a news broadcast, you really home in, you actually study them?
In a way, yes. I just can understand better what's going on.
And you do this every day?
when I get the chance.
Okay, okay. Well, your competition was also an hour, is that true?
Yes.
And about the same number of questions, 50?
Yes. Also, all of the individual have tiebreaker questions at the end.
And were you surprised that you got a perfect score, or is this something that you were pointing toward?
When I took the test, I was confident, but when they started calling out the places, I didn't even think I would place. I was so nervous.
Well, you came out wonderfully. Perfect score. That has to be very rare at that level of competition.
Thank you.
Well, let's hit our listeners with one, maybe two of the questions that were thrown at you during the competition and see how current our listeners are. Go ahead and give us one.
Okay. Who specifically claimed responsibility for the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris?
Who specifically did?
And the options were Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of the Houthis, Hassan Nasrallah, leader of Hezbollah, Abu Bakr Shaka, the leader of Boko Haram, or Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
Wow. I'm going to go with the first one, the leader of ISIS.
The answer was the last one, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
My goodness. And you knew this?
Yes.
Well, congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Well, Jackie, I'd like to get back with you in about the minute we have left here. You have to be very proud of these kids, and they had to have worked unusually hard.
They do work unusually hard. I always tell the parents, I don't have any, it's not like I have grades that I can hold over their head. I have to cajole them into studying, but these kids are self-motivated. When we look for kids on the team, I always look for that competitive spirit and look to see the kids who, when they get a logic problem, are all excited about it, because those are the kids who really, you know, they get a pleasure out of doing well and looking for the correct answers and that type of thing. So we look for kids like that. And so those kids are natural learners. They have a natural curiosity. And so they are really relatively easy to coach. And, of course, they're still middle school kids, so they, you know, they have their other things that they want to do, and sometimes I have to bribe them with snacks and so forth. But they're overall, they're awesome kids, and I just have so much joy. Like they said, it isn't work for me either. I just have so much fun learning with them and being with them. It's really a great pleasure.
Well, regrettably, we are out of time, but thanks so much to head decathlon coach Jackie Brady, and particular thanks to Claire Kraft, Gavin Risling, and Megan Rolette from St. Edward the Confessor School in Dana Point, who are members of that school's state champion academic decathlon team. Big congratulations, and go get them next year.
Thank you so much.
Take
care. And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000. I'm Patrick Mott.